From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The FEC, the Federal Election Commission, regulates the presidential election, and as you may have heard, there's one coming up in 2008. So the FEC is probably fully staffed and humming along, right? No, the group, which is supposed to be composed of 6 members, currently has 3 that are recess appointees. If they are not confirmed, and they may not be, their terms will end very soon, and then the commission will be without a quorum and unable to act after January 1st. So something has to give, or the country could head into an election year without a functioning regulatory body in place to do its job. What would that look like? For some who consider the existence of the FEC an affront to free speech, it would mean a purer freedom. For others who believe that regulation protects us from the corruption that happens when politics meets money, it would be a mess. Think battalions of swift boat smear campaigns. Let's begin with the anti-regulation argument. Brad Smith was once chairman of the FEC. His group is the Center for Competitive Politics, and he joins us now. Brad, welcome to OTM.
Hi, Bob. Thanks.
If there is no FEC after January 1st, what happens?
What would happen is that complaints that are already in the pipeline, that is where people have alleged that others have already violated campaign finance laws, the staff at the FEC would continue to work on those complaints. But the FEC would not be in a position to vote on anything new. They could not vote to approve federal matching funds for candidates who are eligible for federal matching funds. They would not vote to approve audits of campaigns. So all of that would come to an end, and our campaigns would be basically like they were in, say, 1960.
Free-for-alls.
Well, if you think 1960 was just a horrible free-for-all, that's right.
So from your perspective, the best FEC is no FEC at all.
Well, I've served on the FEC, and what I can tell folks is that there are very many complaints filed with the FEC, but virtually none of them have anything to do with preventing corruption in American politics. And if we realize that this country functioned without any kind of federal election commission from its founding until the 1970s, we can look and say, we did okay. We elected some really great presidents. We grew as a country. We prospered, and we did so in an environment in which people were free to speak about politics without worrying about a federal election commission.
Now, you represent a group called Speech Now, which has a novel way of getting around restrictions, and it is, as I understand it, now petitioning the FEC for approval to do so. Can you tell me about its attempt to target candidates it deems anti-free speech?
Speech Now is a group of citizens. They are not a corporation. They take no corporate money. They make no contributions directly to political candidates. Rather, they're just a group of individual citizens who want to speak freely about candidates. And it's a pretty straightforward issue. Are American citizens free to join together to spend their money on politics? The interesting thing here is that everybody agrees. A single individual, be it John Corzine or Michael Bloomberg or George Soros, can start spending all they want to talk about a political candidate. But the law seems to suggest, according to some, that as soon as 2 people get together and do the same thing, somehow they're violating the law. And Speech Now believes that that's a violation not only of their First Amendment rights to speak, but also of their freedom of association, also guaranteed by the First Amendment.
So if there's no FEC after January, there's actually no one to rule on your petition.
Well,
isn't that ironic?
That is an issue, and in that case, the organization will have to weigh up its options because it's interested in running advertisements here in the 2008 campaign.
Now, you were involved in another attempt to circumvent federal campaign finance laws, a very clever one, a high-flying one. It's the Ron Paul blimp. Tell me about it and how it's designed to work.
Sure. Bob, I represent a company called Liberty Political Advertising, and it's important to understand that this project, the Ron Paul blimp, is separate in all ways from the Ron Paul campaign. And the idea here is to sell political advertising in timeshares. So here, what the company has done is purchased a large block of what we would call advertising time, that is a blimp, and then is selling off segments of that time. And individuals who buy time on the blimp will have to file independent expenditure reports with the Federal Election Commission. They are making expenditures on their own right in support of Ron Paul. The FEC has long recognized a commercial exemption. For example, when a campaign goes and hires an advertising agency or a pollster to produce ads for the campaign or to take polls for the campaign, to buy advertising time for the campaign, those companies do not become political committees. They're not limited in any way. Only the payer is. And that's the principle under which Liberty Political Advertising is operating the Ron Paul blimp. They're selling advertising time on the blimp. Individuals who buy that time file independent expenditure reports with the FEC.
So they're not donors. They're purchasers, and it's not a nonprofit PAC or a 527 organization. It is a for-profit company that's selling advertising time. That every one of those ads just happens to be in support of Ron Paul on the side of this blimp.
Right, but let me put it this way to you: if we were to have a company that owned a bunch of billboards and we wanted to sell billboards to George Soros, billboard space, and George Soros ran a bunch of billboards supporting some candidate for president, nobody would say that George Soros could not do this, nor would anybody say that the company somehow became a political committee because it was selling billboard space to George Soros to run ads supporting the candidate of his choice. What Liberty Political Advertising is doing is making that same ability to advertise available to ordinary citizens who can't afford to go out and buy a whole billboard all by themselves.
Well, it's very cunning.
What's fascinating to me is that there are people out there saying, oh, this is a bad thing. Why would somebody think that? There is not a person in this entire United States of America who literally thinks that Ron Paul is somehow being corrupted by this. And that is the only basis that the Supreme Court has recognized as a legitimate one to regulate political speech.
Brad, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Former FEC Chairman Brad Smith is chairman and founder of the Center for Competitive Politics. Paul Ryan is an attorney with the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. He regularly files opinion in opposition to Brad Smith's point of view, and he joins us now. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What do you make of the Ron Paul blimp, which will run ads that are purchased, like ordinary ad time, in expenditures by individuals? It seems to circumvent all existing campaign finance reform attempts, no?
Well, for one thing, we don't know whether or not the Ron Paul blimp efforts are or are not legal. The Federal Election Commission hasn't weighed in on the issue. I will say that it's a very creative approach to circumventing federal campaign finance laws. One of the things that makes the Ron Paul blimp operation look a whole lot more like a political committee than an independent business advertising operation is that the folks running the blimp decided what the message on the blimp is going to be. Unlike an advertising company, unlike a billboard company, for example, that would gladly accept people walking in the door wanting to buy billboard space to put up any message that the person paying for the ad wants, the Ron Paul blimp operation's much, much different. In the Ron Paul blimp operation, the folks running the so-called advertising company have determined the message. They've determined where the message is going to run. They've determined the duration that the message will be running. And they're simply asking people to fund that. It appears to be right on the cusp of any issues that have been dealt with by the Federal Election Commission in the past. I don't believe they've dealt with or decided how to treat this type of group before.
Well, tell me about the precedent there. Has the FEC or have the courts ruled on a case where something that looks like a duck and quacks like a duck but is designed technically not to be a duck can operate lawfully?
I don't know of any precedent that's directly on point, but some of the most recent examples of efforts to get around existing laws were all the 527 organizations that were active back in the 2004 presidential election cycle. There, the lawyers for these 527 groups were pointing to a definition in the campaign finance law, the definition of expenditure, and interpreting it to mean that unless they say explicitly vote for or vote against a candidate, they're not making an expenditure, and therefore they aren't covered by the campaign finance laws.
So you could do a swift voting smear against John Kerry, for example. If you don't say don't vote Kerry, you, at least on a technicality, don't fall within the purview of the regulation.
Well, that was certainly the interpretation of the law that was given by the attorneys that were hired by these groups to keep them presumably on the right side of the law. Unfortunately, from their perspective, the Federal Election Commission concluded that these groups broke the law by not registering as political committees back in 2004, and that this definition, this interpretation of what is and is not an expenditure by these groups and their lawyers was incorrect.
As we head into 2008, with the very real possibility of having no active Federal Election Commission, this raises the question of what difference does it make whether there is one or isn't one, because their rulings almost always are ex post facto after the damage has been done.
I've been a very vocal critic in past years of the lax fines that have been imposed by the Federal Election Commission, even with respect to these 527 organizations that the commission found broke the law. The fines that they gave them, although they create a little bit of sticker shock because they were in the several hundreds of thousands of dollars, they amounted to only roughly 1% of the funds that these groups illegally raised and spent back in 2004.
A cost of doing the smear business.
Yes. But that being said, I do think there's great value in having an administrative agency like the Federal Election Commission, and there are comparable agencies at the state and local government levels around the country. They should be repaired, but they are valuable and important pieces of the campaign finance law enforcement process.
Well, that brings us all the way around to where we started this discussion. Hypothetically, what does an unregulated campaign look like in 2008?
Even if there is no Federal Election Commission on the job for the first couple months of 2008, it's not to say that once the Federal Election Commission itself is reconstituted, that it won't go back and reexamine all the activities that occurred during the election cycle in which the commission may have been absent. It can, at any time down the road, I believe the statute of limitations is 5 years. So just because the sheriff may not be in town doesn't mean that there are no laws on the books that need to be abided by.
Well, Paul, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Paul Ryan is an attorney with the Campaign Legal Center.
Coming up, a journalist visits New Hampshire.
Oh, that's new. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Every 4 years, journalists migrate like swallows, swarm like locusts, stampede like reporters up to New Hampshire. They go to take the pulse of Granite Staters, who are designated the pulse of the nation because they have the first primary. This week, I went to New Hampshire to visit the public radio station there, and I thought I'd do a piece about how the residents feel about playing bit parts in the nation's quadrennial political soap opera. Naturally, I assumed they thoroughly hated reporters. I was wrong. In fact, the real story is how they feel about their primary, or rather, the primacy of their primary. Many people, especially Democrats, hate the current system because they don't believe that the white, rural, relatively affluent people of New Hampshire reflect the party's rank and file. Regularly, other states try to leapfrog over New Hampshire. This year it was Michigan, which moved its primary to January 15th. New Hampshire responded by moving its to the 8th. New Hampshire has pushed up its primary a week for each of the last three election cycles.
We didn't start the fire. It's not us. It's those people pushing us. Stop pushing.
Joe McQuaid is the publisher of the Manchester Union Leader. He's worried that the next New Hampshire primary could be held in the year before the election.
We don't want to do that. I hope people see that we are determined and cooler heads will prevail as they usually do. But I don't think we should have it on the 4th of July.
But
that's my line in the sand right there. 4th of July. No.
New Hampshire's state emblem is a great stone face carved by nature into a series of cliffs called the Old Man of the Mountain. Wouldn't he, the most literal of Granite Staters, resent being a sideshow in the electoral circus?
I think sometimes even the ones who claim to be annoyed are secretly quite proud of the primary. Hey, Mabel, we may be on with Katie Couric tonight. Did you see Charlie Gibson? He's broadcasting from the top of the Victory parking garage the last couple nights. Great stuff.
What do you think would happen to the state psyche should New Hampshire no longer be first?
That's too terrible to contemplate. It's like saying, what would happen if the Old Man of the Mountain fell down? Whoops, wait a minute. He did fall down.
When reporters want the word on the New Hampshire street, they go inside. It's too cold on the street. In Manchester, they go to eateries like the Merrimack, Pappy's Pizza, and the Red Arrow. I went to all three. At the Merrimack, I met Betsy Gauthier.
How would you feel if New Hampshire were no longer the first primary and the soap opera moved elsewhere?
No, I wouldn't like that. We like to be first.
Do you think that you're qualified to be first, to speak for the rest of the nation at the very beginning of this campaign?
Absolutely.
What makes you say that?
We've been doing it for many, many years.
Doesn't necessarily mean you're good at it.
Oh, no, but we are. We take it very seriously.
At Pappy's Pizza, I asked Joe Lamont if he thought his access to the candidates qualified him to cast a primary vote that has more impact than the primary votes of thousands of other Americans combined.
Oh, yeah. And then some. I know as much as they do, so.
About urban poverty, racial issues, immigration.
Yeah, I think I have a good handle on all of that, yeah.
As somebody who lives in New York, I never reach out and touch any candidate because they don't care what I think and they don't care about my vote. So I think it's unfair that they only care about yours.
Oh, well, moved to New Hampshire.
And at the legendary Red Arrow Diner, I asked 18-year-old Joseph David Frank Bora, a.k.a. Joner, and Eric Werfula if they were bothered by all the media attention.
What are we doing right now? We're getting attention from the media because we're from New Hampshire. I don't mind it.
You think we don't need this every once in a while?
Come on, we need the self-esteem.
If it wasn't for skiing and maple syrup, no one would come to New Hampshire other than for the primaries.
And the leaves.
The leaves are nice.
Foliage notwithstanding, the people of New Hampshire are political animals.
New Hampshire, as you probably know, has the third largest English-speaking deliberative body in the world.
Manchester Union Leader publisher Joe McQuaid.
I can never remember the other two. I think one is Congress and one may be the British Parliament. We have 400 reps, 24 state senators. If you're not in the legislature in New Hampshire, your uncle is, or the guy down the street is, or your school teacher is.
One representative for every 3,089 citizens. Apply that same ratio to California, they'd have to elect 12,000.
It was this belief a long time ago that the more people here who could share the government, the better. And so that makes for a different environment.
New Hampshire's Secretary of State, Bill Gardner, sets the date for the primary. It's written into the law that it shall occur a week before every other primary. For Gardner, it's not just state law, it's natural law.
There's a reason why the Kentucky Derby is in Kentucky. There's a reason why the Statue of Liberty is in New York. There are other historic harbors, Baltimore, New Orleans. If they said it's not fair that the Statue of Liberty is always in New York, so we need to tow it to Baltimore for a few years, let it be rotated. Then we'll tow it to New Orleans and let New Orleans have it for a few years. Well, there's a reason why it's in New York Harbor. And there's a reason why this unique political culture is here and is nowhere else.
That reason has everything to do with history. Robert La Follette, the progressive governor of Wisconsin, created the first primary in 1905 so that the people, rather than the party bosses, could choose the candidates. A lot of states jumped on the bandwagon, but then jumped off again. By the 50s and 60s, even the 70s, only a few states held primaries. What happened?
They'd have one primary, some states maybe two, and then the big shots. The party leaders would go to the legislature and say, look, it's costing a lot of money to have the people do this, and they don't participate in high numbers. Let us have the power back. And so state after state gave the power back. Well, in this state, the people prevailed, and they said, no, we want to make this decision. We care about this, and we're going to keep it. And so New Hampshire kept it while state after state got rid of it. Then after we've had it for a half a century, all of a sudden, a state that's bigger and more powerful says they should have it. We just said, no, we're not going to just give this up. We never took it from anyone else. We don't think it's right to take it from us, and we're going to protect it.
Not just because New Hampshire earned it, says Gardner, and certainly not because of the money, about $30 million.
One NASCAR race brings in more money for this state, whether it be the hotels or the restaurants, than the presidential primary.
He also wants to protect the primary because it's good for America to have a place that matters where there are virtually no barriers to running.
The American dream that any person's son or daughter can someday grow up to be president, there's a place that can happen, and it's here. When Jimmy Carter came here, no one had any idea who he was. He didn't have the accent that we have. He didn't grow up in the environment that exists here. But he came, and using his shoe leather, he went from place to place and talked about why he was running and who he was, you know, Jimmy who, and that demonstrated his character. And he ends up winning this primary.
By the time I finally got to New Hampshire Public Radio, I was convinced that preserving the New Hampshire primary was the only way to save American democracy. NHPR executive editor John Greenberg told me I may have OD'd on the state Kool-Aid.
The Kool-Aid is that you think that anybody who has great communication skills and great convictions can come into New Hampshire, meet enough people, and out of whole cloth, generate a presidential campaign just simply by that quintessential contact of aspiring politician and the people. And it doesn't work that way.
He says Jimmy Carter probably couldn't have pulled off his victory today. There's not enough time now between New Hampshire's primary and all the rest to build the necessary momentum.
I mean, for example, John McCain won in New Hampshire in 2000. But because he couldn't convert that quickly enough into a campaign organization with money, with advertising in South Carolina, he died in South Carolina. That's the point at which the New Hampshire myth gets beaten down by reality.
Granite Staters are not immune to the power of campaign money, ads, and polls, says Greenberg, but they have built up more resistance than those in other states. Like other kinds of resistance, it comes from frequent exposure. And of course, there's that political culture, decades of asking tough questions of presidential contenders face-to-face and hosting political house parties.
So over the past 50 years, I do in fact think what has developed in this state is something that can't just simply be replicated elsewhere because you say to the people of that state, oh, now you're first.
And that's the conclusion of a Granite Stater who hasn't drunk the Kool-Aid. Now a final word from the man with the recipe, Secretary of State Bill Gardner.
If you look at this primary from a distance or in an academic way, you can come up with all kinds of reasons why it doesn't make sense. It's not fair that it's this privilege every 4 years, and it's not right that it's the same place. But there are things in life that you have to experience because you wouldn't believe it otherwise. And this is one of them. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said that an ounce of history is worth a pound of logic. And that, to me, says everything about this.
Gardner says he will move the primary as early as he has to. Yes, even to the 4th of July to preserve it. Eventually, though, even things that seem eternal crumble under constant pressure. The ancient stone face called the Old Man of the Mountain collapsed in 2003. But New Hampshire losing the first primary? I think Gardner will be a lot harder to crack.
This past summer, on the last page of the New Republic in the so-called diarist section, several entries ran from a soldier serving in Iraq, bylined Scott Thomas. In one entry, he described the sick things he and his fellow soldiers do to keep their sense of humor, including intentionally killing dogs with Bradley vehicles, making fun of a woman in the mess hall who had been disfigured by an IED, and making a skull cap out of an actual piece of skull. Writers and bloggers, especially on the right, were immediately skeptical and flagged the pieces as dubious. This month, Franklin Foer, editor of the New Republic, finally responded with a detailed account of what happened. In the end, the very end, he concluded that they should not have printed the pieces or put that soldier, whose real name was Scott Thomas Beauchamp, and who was married to the New Republic's fact-checker, in that position. One of the groups leading the chorus of condemnation against the New Republic was the National Review Online, and it too has run into trouble recently with its own soldier-turned-reporter. Retired Marine W. Thomas Smith, Jr. reported on the National Review's blog that, among other things, between 4,000 and 5,000 Hezbollah gunmen had been deployed to the Christian areas in Beirut. No one else reported that because it didn't happen. The National Review eventually admitted that it shouldn't have posted Smith's reporting without more substantiation, and last week Smith and the National Review Online parted ways. Both cases highlight the difficulties of including the informal accounts of soldiers alongside the work of professional journalists. Military historian Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bateman says there's nothing new about news outlets enlisting soldiers as scribes, nor the arguments that ensue.
Certainly, the medium of the internet is new. But in the American Civil War, when we had so many thousands upon thousands of local newspapers, obviously no local newspaper could afford a journalist to go cover the local regiment. And so editors used to pay local soldiers to send home letters to the local newspaper. That really was how most Americans learned about war. But when you had basically a private writing home to his hometown paper and saying, this happened at the Battle of Gettysburg, 6 or 7 years later, you may see disputes inside that small town where two guys disagreed about what happened. The difference from then to today is, then it took 7 years for those disputes to come to the air. Now it takes maybe 70 minutes.
So you read these pieces by Beauchamp. What was your first thought?
I'm an infantry officer and have studied infantrymen at least back 200 or 300 years, and I can comfortably assert that we're not a nice crowd. I thought, this is not beyond the pale, but the details related to what he described, they set off my alarms that all was not as it appeared.
Now, in his expansive explanation of what went wrong at the New Republic, it ran to 14 pages, Franklin Foer mentioned more than once that it was very, very difficult to verify any of the things that Scott Thomas Beauchamp was saying because, after all, it was taking place in a theater of war. Do you buy that?
I don't buy it at all. Now, I understand that my profession with our public affairs officers has not covered itself in glory with regards to getting access to people who have queries. But on the flip side of that same coin, what really distresses me is that there was not a single person, apparently, at the New Republic who had any personal relationship with a career military person who could tell them, yo, you're being fed a line here, and then help them figure out what was really going on.
Seems to me that Scott Thomas Beauchamp and Thomas Smith committed similar but not necessarily identical sins here. Can you characterize who you believe was the worse offender?
No, I think both are equally, in different ways, journalistically dangerous. One depicts a scenario which, were it true, would have resulted in civil war and perhaps regional war.
That's the Hezbollah marching through Christian Beirut.
Which was patently false. The other painted a scenario or scenarios which are possible and indeed probable in some situations. But if you think about the movie Platoon, this was a 1980s movie that depicted a whole series of horrific events that occurred inside a single unit at a single time. Well, all of those things occurred, but almost none of them all occurred inside of a single small unit inside of a single year. I think what Scott Thomas Beauchamp was doing was something similar to that.
Now, people like Oliver Stone have said that there's the nominal facts and then there's the larger truth. Is there anything to an argument that, well, it doesn't really matter if they're getting the details a little wrong or if they're combining incidents to heighten their drama, that ultimately the underlying truth is still being served?
Within academia, we acknowledge the existence of the capital T truth, the truth which transcends the facts on the ground. But mostly, that is the purview of people like Joseph Heller and Kurt Vonnegut and James Jones. Now, their fiction may capture the capital T truth, but they're not depicted as journalists. Scott Thomas Beauchamp may well be his generation's Kurt Vonnegut, but I don't think he can be trusted to write journalistic accounts.
Bob, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Military historian Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bateman spoke as an individual, not as a representative of the Department of Defense.
Coming up, subliminal advertising has never been real.
But somehow I can't get it out of my head. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The word sex imprinted in Ritz crackers, naked women in ice cubes. The idea of subliminal messaging rests on the notion that words and images lurking in advertising and products themselves can manipulate us, like Manchurian candidates of consumerism, into desiring certain brands of whiskey or soft drinks or whatever. The problem is that subliminal ads don't exist and basically never have. The whole concept was born out of a lie, a 50-year-old lie, yet lingers, like many an urban myth, in the public's imagination. Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media ecology at New York University. He joins us now. Mark, welcome back to On the Media.
Great to be with you, Bob.
How did the words subliminal advertising enter the collective vocabulary?
In 1957, an enterprising marketing researcher named James Vickery announced to a breathless world that he had conducted an experiment in a movie theater in Fort Lee, New Jersey, during screenings of the William Holden picture Picnic. Vickery claimed that what he had done was to flash subliminal inducements during the screening of the film, telling people to drink Coca-Cola or to eat popcorn. His claim was that those subliminal flashes had actually increased sales of those items at the concession stand in the theater by some 38%. This announcement took the country by storm. People basically freaked out over it. The networks swore they would never engage in practices like this. The New York State Senate passed a law against this kind of thing. Aldous Huxley appeared on the Mike Wallace show and referred to it as something far worse than anything he'd imagined in Brave New World. It was quite a to-do. And the irony is that it turned out that Vickery had made the whole thing up.
What was in it for Vickery?
His hope was that marketers, advertisers, would be impressed by his achievement here and hire him to sell their goods by fair means or foul.
On the subject of what motivated Vickery, motivation was at the heart of what was a burgeoning science or pseudoscience in advertising in those days called motivation research. Tell me about it and how America found out about what they called MR.
Motivation research really was the latest chapter in the rather long history of psychology being used on behalf of advertising. This was not a brand new thing in the 50s. Advertising agencies had hired psychologists for some time, but it wasn't until after World War II that this kind of deep, careful, one could argue, highly manipulative sort of research became a very standard practice and a really growing industry. And the reason why this new discipline came to public attention was Vance Packard's book, The Hidden Persuaders, which came out in 1957, a few months before James Vickery made his dramatic announcement. And it became an enormous bestseller, basically acquainted the American people with the fact that motivation research was ongoing, was costing the advertising industry a great deal of money, and that, at least according to Packard, was wildly successful.
Now, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of The Hidden Persuaders, you have written the foreword for the reissue. Do you believe that his journalism on this subject was sound?
He does tend, I think, to exaggerate the effectiveness of MR more than maybe a more careful scholar would do. On the other hand, I think that as a study of a corporate intention, The Hidden Persuaders is really quite valuable. For example, take a look at the redesign and the, as it were, the remarketing of Marlboro cigarettes, which, as you know, had been a woman's brand for decades. And in 1954, Philip Morris decided to completely reinvent the brand and make it into a man's filter cigarette. The Marlboro campaign relied on an unprecedented amount of deep motivational research, psychological research, color research, research of all kinds. And this scientific approach turned out to be enormously successful.
The single most successful advertising campaign of all time.
Exactly. The Hidden Persuaders is really a very valuable book because it sheds some light on attempts at manipulation that have since then evolved into something far larger. For example, he talks in one chapter on what he calls the psycho-seduction of children. He talks about trying to get little girls to ask their parents for home permanent sets. He talks about Miss Frances, who was a very popular children's show host at the time, actually telling kids about taking pills. This stuff really appalled Packard 50 years ago. It's wise, I think, to turn to his book to be reminded that this kind of thing, which we see not only in product marketing, but in politics and in various other fields of endeavor, is really, in a sense, fundamentally opposed to democracy.
So it really doesn't matter whether they were successful in seducing us subliminally. The fact is they were certainly willing to try. And the result of that, five decades later, is the various social pathologies, including body image obsession and fast food gorging and God knows what all, perpetrated by Madison Avenue. But what's interesting about Vance Packard to me is that it didn't just come out of nowhere. It happened at a certain period of time, namely right in the wake of the Korean War, when stories of brainwashing were very much top of mind. Can you talk about that connection?
It was an intensely anti-communist era, and people were thinking about mind control and brainwashing and that kind of manipulation as a largely communist phenomenon, that this is what the Soviets were trying to do. Right around the time that The Hidden Persuaders came out, J. Edgar Hoover's book Masters of Deceit was high on the bestseller lists. What makes The Hidden Persuaders quite interesting, as you suggest, is that here was a very mainstream journalist making the case, with quite a bit of documentation, that the real brainwashers were right here in the USA and working within the context of what we call free enterprise.
But then came a book in the 70s, which I believe was titled Subliminal Seduction by Wilson Bryan Key, which took the idea of subliminal advertising about 11 steps farther and made some absolutely preposterous assertions, including the sex imprinted in Ritz crackers one. It was a huge bestseller and continues, I believe, to be in the hip pockets of college psychology students even to this day.
God forbid. His first book was indeed called Subliminal Seduction, and I think wrote two others after that. He's got one, I think the third one, which is called The Clam Plate Orgy, which unfortunately is about just that, the idea that a photograph of a plate of fried clams is actually a picture of a wild orgy. Now, I don't think he was a charlatan. He really believed that these things were crammed into all kinds of pictures around us. And he did lecture extensively on the college circuit. So it is indeed the case that the urban legend that advertising is suffused with this kind of invisible suasion, that comes from Wilson Key. And there is indeed no basis for this in reality.
Well, Mark, thank you very much, Bob Eugenis, for joining us, Bob Eugenis.
Thank you.
Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media ecology, Bob Eugenis, at New York University. His book, Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform, is now out, Bob Eugenis, in paperback. Mark, anything you want to add?
You're a genius.
I feel particular concern, apprehension, in connection with these operations of the manipulators. Their growing boldness in invading the privacy of our minds.
That was Vance Packard speaking in 1958. Subliminal advertising may have only been a potent myth, but the potential for violating the privacy of our minds for profit is alive and well. Last week, we visited a billboard on Prince Street in New York City that is among the first of its kind to find a way past the indifference of even the most detached New Yorker. The billboard is flanked by devices that look like speakers, but which direct highly focused sound at unsuspecting persons who trigger a sensor by walking by. The sound is sent at a frequency that can only be heard by them. That's because the transmitter uses the skull as a speaker, and so the sound resonates inside the head.
It's not your imagination. What was that? Who's there?
The billboard is advertising a new paranormal series on A&E, and though the speakers weren't working when we went by, it's been effective enough to scare even the person who was being paid to answer questions about it.
And as I was walking by, I heard a loud noise. I didn't know what it was, and I ran. I just didn't know where it was coming from. And people have been coming by all day saying, where's this sound coming from? Every time I walk by, I feel like it's in my head.
Prince Street may be the frontier when it comes to in-head advertising, but technology writer Clive Thompson explains that it's part of a wave of new devices with designs on your mind. After visiting the billboard, we sat down at a local cafe to talk with Clive about the larger implications of the new persuaders.
This technology is part of a new legal area, ethical area, that you could call the civil rights of the mind. It's an idea that was created by this organization down in California called the Center for Cognitive Liberties. And essentially, what they're concerned about is that a lot of technological innovations are eroding the sanctity of your mind, the privacy of your mind, because you've got technologies that can read what's on your mind, so it's no longer private, and you've got technologies that can put things inside your head, like this one. It can literally say, your head is not safe just for your own thoughts. We're going to make you hear voices. And you can't cover your ears to not hear it, because the way the technology works is that it's making your body resonate and become the device for making the noise. And so they're essentially very concerned about the fact that we're developing technologies faster than we're updating our legal and moral and ethical ways of thinking about it. Because up until now, we've been accustomed to the idea that the one truly private place is inside your own head.
Can you give me a couple of quick examples of how what's inside your head is no longer private because of technological advances?
So one example of reading what's inside your head is the increasing use of MRIs to do lie detection. And obviously that's something you sort of have to volunteer for, because you have to be lying down with your head inside an MRI tube. But there's a lot of development of technologies that can do it without you knowing that they're doing it. There's a bunch of scientists that I've spoken to that have been working on using infrared light to essentially shine it at your forehead, and they read the blood activity in your prefrontal cortex. And what they've discovered is that by seeing what the blood activity, the amount of oxygen being carried to your prefrontal cortex is, they can tell whether or not you're sort of in, it's a lovely phrase, mental anguish. And they've noticed, and it's true, that you experience a lot of mental anguish, for example, a millisecond before you formulate a lie. In fact, I've experienced this myself. I've had this infrared beam shot into my skull, and I've seen the scans, and you can tell milliseconds before I even know that I'm going to lie, that I'm going to lie. The scientists that are working on that are developing techniques for doing it at distance, maybe, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 feet, so they could conceivably do it without you knowing it's being done to you. Like, for example, in an airport, you'd be scanned not just for the presence of explosives, but for the presence of mental anguish. Again, you know, the idea is that your thoughts are supposed to be private. And if your thoughts become unprivate, where do you stop? Is it possible to peer inside your head at all and only look at part of what you're doing? These are really, really deep questions that are being accelerated because a lot of this technology, it's in the lab right now, but it's starting to come out of the lab, like the hypersonic sound projections.
Let's talk about the hypersonic sound projections. This makes an attempt to put something in your head. In this case, it's just an awareness of a TV show that purports to follow real-life Ghostbuster-like people around.
The thing about hypersonic sound transmission is that there actually are a lot of really interesting, quote-unquote, good ways to use it. People have talked about using it as a car dashboard enhancement, right? So instead of having to take your eyes off the road, the car can just beam information directly into your head so you're hearing it really well and clearly.
Can't you simply do that by having your dashboard talk to you the way they do now?
It's really a question of clarity. It could help overwhelm a lot of other acoustic sound inside the car that you might not hear it over, like, for example, the radio and whatnot. They say, you know, you're really going too fast. Or you could have simply fun applications, you know, kids beaming messages to each other's heads, you know. You could have it in certain search and rescue situations. It's very hard to communicate with people over a long distance in a loud environment. The ability to sort of beam a message directly to someone in a focused way, like a laser point from hundreds of feet away, could be incredibly useful. But there's a lot of significantly scary ways it could be used. It could be used by the military. They're already looking at deploying it. I think that in some cases they probably already have, as a crowd control technique. One can imagine a way in that you could, you know, pick certain people out of a crowd and just blast incredibly loud noise just at them. Everyone around him, you know, won't have any problem. And there's one guy who's writhing on the ground. So there's a lot of very, very unsettling ways to use the technology.
It reminds me of that scene in Minority Report, the Spielberg film, where Tom Cruise is walking through a futuristic mall and this sign says, you know, how did those turtlenecks work out for you, Mr. So-and-so? And obviously they're beaming specifically targeted signs to everybody walking through that crowded mall.
Obviously, the marketing and advertising potentials for the technology are pretty big. And they're sort of, I mean, I guess you could say they're kind of in the gray area between evil and good. Exactly. Because, like, even the most, you know, seemingly invasive forms of advertising can actually be useful for you as a consumer. And you could imagine situations in which you actually do want to be sort of picked out and told something specific. I'm not really sure I want to be the first one, you know, experiencing that. And overall, my sense is I would find it personally invasive and creepy. But, you know, I'm 39. Maybe I'm too old for this stuff. Maybe, you know, like 21-year-olds, you know, when they're 30, would be just completely accepting of the fact that as you walk down the street, you have targeted messages speaking to you every once in a while. It is also possible that the people that try to do this with marketing will just find that their customers are so annoyed at them that they'll stop doing it because it causes more annoyance than it causes sales.
Can you talk about it as an environmental issue?
Sure. There's this whole other field, acoustic ecology, basically, which is, you know, the question as to are there any quiet places left in society? It's a global issue. There's actually people that are worried there's no places left on Earth pristine from mechanical sound. In an urban sense, people have always been concerned about the increasing noise because it's been pretty clearly proven that when you're subject to noise that you can't control, it does bad things to you. It causes stress. IQ points drop off in kids. You get less ability to concentrate and do well in school when you have noise distraction. All these problems are already there. And so if you start layering on other technology that says, okay, now we're going to start actively targeting not just something that's ambient that you can sort of turn your head away from, but something that's actually inside your head, that's a significant problem. This is exactly why this stuff is both a technological issue and a marketing issue, but also an ethical and a civil rights issue. Does our legal tradition, does our constitutional tradition have any answers for these types of technologies? These are open legal questions right now, as I understand it. They're going to have to be answered. And the question is, are they going to be answered before the technology is omnipresent, or is the technology going to get ahead of our ability to think about what it means for our mental privacy?
Clive Thompson is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and Wired.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Jennifer Munson is our acting technical director, and Paul Schneider, our engineer. We had help from Jessica McGaldy and Ian Whitehead. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
What was that? Who's there?
Support for On the Media is provided by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, offering a new one-year Master of Arts degree program for experienced journalists. Journalism.columbia.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.